Time now for What's Left and Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Tuesday afternoon. Happy birthday, Corey Gold.
Happy birthday, Corey.
Yeah, happy Age of Aquarius.
We didn't have a chance to say it on your show, but we say it on ours. Glad you're here.
That's right. It's a beautiful day, Dr. Future.
It's another windswept day in here in Santa Cruz.
The winds are blowing.
Beautiful on the weekend, beach weather. A little windy today. However, it's still gorgeous.
I like to call it the golden age of global warming.
It was balmy yesterday and the day before. It was Hawaii around here.
Exactly. It's like summertime.
I don't tell any of my friends back in Indiana.
Yeah. Well, that's why we came here, right?
Exactly.
We have a lot of news to cover, so I wanted to start off fairly quickly with some of the information as things are coming down. Stuff that hopefully you'll be able to use, news you can use, as we say.
News you can use.
First is the Verizon iPhone versus the AT&T iPhone. There's been a lot of studies now on the new Verizon iPhone that just came out, and it's pretty good. It's holding up quite well against the AT&T iPhone. It seems to be a better phone. CNET's done some major tests across San Francisco.
So wait a second, Dr. Future, what's the big deal?
Well, the big deal is that AT&T has had the exclusive rights to iPhone for all these years.
And now they don't.
And now they don't.
And now Verizon can do it.
That's right, the other big carrier in this country.
And we've known, well, I've had the experience where Verizon has better customer service than AT&T.
And it seems like the CDMA is a little bit better in quality for the phone as well. So that seems to be catching on. The main thing is that the data rates sometimes are faster on AT&T from some of the studies that I've seen. But overall, they're very comparative in that way. There's a couple of advantages to the Verizon and a couple of disadvantages. One of the advantages is that, well, it's newer. It's got its antenna in a different place. It has a better phone capability, and the data seems to be pretty good. One of the disadvantages is that it is not able to do voice and data at the same time. So you can't be on the phone and doing maps at the same time.
Oh.
You know, I don't know how often you do that.
Well, that's how the iPhone for AT&T was when it first came out, right? Is that a function of the 3G, 4G network, maybe?
No, it's a function of the CDMA network.
CDMA.
Yeah.
CDMA, that's the Verizon network,
That's
huh?
the Verizon network, right.
And so AT&T has, what's the other network?
GSM.
Yes.
Which is the AT&T and the Verizon, which is the CDMA. Those are the two main. There's T-Mobile also, which is, I believe, the GSM.
Verizon phone has all four networks. Is that right? No. All Verizon is CDMA.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. The big change is the fact that they have it. And apparently they sold out way in advance. The pre-orders are there, and it's happening. The unknown question is whether or not the network can hold up to the increased load that's going to happen.
Right.
I think it's February 10th.
February 10th, yeah. And my understanding is that they have pre-sold. Let's see. Originally, people could sign up for unlimited data service on their Verizon iPhone. But then just recently, they've made it so that you can only have a limited amount of data service. And there's no unlimited plans available. Just like AT&T.
Well, they're initially going to offer unlimited, but there's actually a cap on it. You know,
there's a cap on the unlimited?
Yeah, it's not really going to be unlimited for any length of time. We had that with AT&T. We had unlimited on all of our devices. We had two iPhones in the family and an iPad. We got the unlimited plans, and now you can't get them anymore. And if you
not
change them
AT&T.
At all, if you update the program, you can't get it. Like today, we just were in the AT&T store. We wanted to tether one of our phones.
Oh, so wait a second, Dr. Future. What is this tether?
Tethering is where you connect your phone to your computer. So if you're in an area where you don't have any Wi-Fi hotspots or anything and you still want to get your computer online, what do? Well, you connect your phone to your computer.
And then you can just get online.
Yeah, you just get online using the data plan.
How modems used to get online. You first call the phone company and then you send your data through your phone line.
Dial-up! That's how we were saving Egypt last week.
Yeah, digital dial-up.
Yeah, this is an updated version of that.
Digital dial-up. I guess you could look at it that way. It's a little faster, though. You actually have DSL speeds. over the 3G network.
Speaking of Egypt, Dr. Future.
So to there's a lot on the Verizon thing.
I'm sorry.
The question is whether or not the network will hold up under the upcoming onslaught of Verizon phones getting on. If Verizon's been preparing for it. Apparently, they have been planning to throttle back the users who use a lot of data.
Yeah, the top 5% of users are going to get slowed down in their data reception.
If they go over 2 gigabytes of data usage in a month.
That's a lot. I remember when I went to Yugoslavia and I bought one of those little thumb drives I was telling you about where I could get into the cellular web in Serbia. Mm-hmm. And I could just take my little laptop and be online wherever there was cellular reception.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember how many mega kilobytes.
Well, just to give you an idea, if you stream KSCO radio over your phone, you know, go to kso.com/live or click on the live button, you'd be able to stream 4 hours a day for most of the month before your 2 gigabyte usage would be up.
4 hours a day.
Yeah.
Every day for a month.
Yeah.
Audio only.
Who are these people using 2 gigabytes of
data? Video uses a lot more.
Yeah.
So if you're a YouTube user.
So if you're watching YouTube.
Yeah,
video,
it goes really fast.
You know, one DVD in high res is about 4 or 5 gigs.
But 2 gigabyte is plenty if you're not doing multimedia. Multimedia just sucks down that data, though. It gets really... And the thing is that the whole industry is moving more towards the cloud all the time, and more of your information is going to be online and all your videos and movies. And so the cloud is becoming more important, and the data rates are going to be important. You know, 2 gigabytes is going to seem like nothing a year or two from now.
You know, when I think about Tether, it makes me think of Tether Ball.
Yeah,
right?
Me too.
And so there's like this little tiny string connecting your little ball to this pole that's in the cloud somewhere.
You see, Verizon is offering something that AT&T isn't yet along those lines. Like you said, tethering is by connecting your laptop to your phone by a cord. Now, the Wi-Fi hotspot option that's going to be in the Verizon phone will allow you to be unconnected. You'll be able to basically turn your phone into a Wi-Fi router, and up to 5 machines will be able to connect to your phone using its data and bandwidth.
Holy moly, 5 laptops will be able to be connected to my little iPhone.
You'll be a little mini hotspot.
I'll be the mini hotspot.
Everyone will be
dependent
on you.
You're already a mini hotspot.
You charge them all a few dollars, and you have a little business going.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Future, are hotspots, do they make use of Bluetooth, or do they have some other way
no,
of connecting?
No, this is Wi-Fi. This is a
Wi-Fi.
It's a Wi-Fi antenna, Wi-Fi transmission. But the phones all have Bluetooth as well. And I do believe the AT&T option allows you to do a Bluetooth connection to your laptop, so it doesn't have to be via a USB cable necessarily. Mm-hmm. But the Bluetooth is one-on-one. It's only one-to-one. Mm-hmm. You can't exchange more than that. So we'll see whether or not Verizon spurs AT&T to developing the Wi-Fi hotspot for the other smartphones.
The beauty of capitalism and anti-monopoly.
On AT&T, yes.
The two-party phone system, I guess.
So, Dr. Future, Egypt is in the news again?
Indeed.
Every day.
And I don't know how many of you folks saw Anderson Cooper last night.
He seemed traumatized.
He just came back.
Never going to be the same.
Is his hair whiter?
His skin is.
Oh, no.
He's
definitely pale, huh? Anderson
was very concerned. He said this is the most dangerous time right now.
What? You mean he's there?
No, he's back.
No, he is very, very concerned because the proposed new replacement from Mubarak, I don't have his name in front of me, but he has been the vice president, and apparently he is sort of thought of internationally as a torturer.
Oh.
And
he was head of intelligence.
Right. And yet there is some...
Agencies do interrogations and
secret
police and all that.
No, but very specifically, he was considered to be responsible for doing some of the state-mandated torture, I hate to say it, requested by the FBI and the CIA in some of their prisoner interrogations.
Let's see if they want to talk with us about this. I think this is Michael. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, yeah. Michael. Welcome on the Dr. Future Show.
Hello, Dr. Future. How's it going?
Oh, we're great. Great. Yeah. Glad to take your call. Do you have something to say about the Egypt situation?
Well, yeah, I'd kind of been following it since the beginning, and I've just been thinking about how the kill switch was engaged and how things were going on. And I just heard the thing about Anderson Cooper that you all were mentioning. And
right.
I thought it was really interesting about Anderson Cooper in particular. particular and saying how this is a real dangerous time because, in particular, they had really cleaned out the square, from what I understand, from what I've been following since the very beginning of this on Al Jazeera, as far as the coverage goes.
You know, the day of departure day. You don't know if that was, like, the media declaring that or who thought it was going to be a day of departure day, not the protesters, obviously.
Well, what had happened was they had actually called it a day of departure day. The protesters did, actually, because what they had decided that day was going to be the day. And it was really interesting to watch that many people come together in that instance because they had used the government itself, because you were mentioning about them being worried because the vice president had basically been linked to the mandated torturing that was requested by the FBI in America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, part of the worryingness of it, and what's not really being mentioned, is kind of the crossover of Nixonism and the Mubarakism by putting undercover people in, which is basically essentially what the government itself did by taking plainclothes policemen and then interspersing them in these crowds to create what Anderson Cooper is probably referring to as a dangerous zone, or what is a volatile region.
Yeah.
So before that, go ahead.
Isn't it classically called, it's a form of destabilization policy that's mandated by the state to sort of make it look like pedestrians are fighting amongst themselves, but really it's very powerful moneyed interest seeding violence so that it's not obvious where it all began.
Precisely, and that's the nature of the undercover part of it, in which, the, as you mentioned, destabilization, to actually say it correctly. Yeah, which is essentially what was happening with the Egyptian government when they created the volatile area inside of that peaceful demonstration. Because they did a couple of things which, if it's such a dangerous place, I thought it was very interesting that Christian people actually stood guard over top of the Muslims when they were praying to watch.
Yeah, I saw that. That was pretty impressive.
To make sure that they weren't attacked. And then on top of it, there have been several times where Muslims and Christian prayers have been done collectively in that square to show a unity between both religions and the people. So it's kind of hard to believe that it's an incredibly, dangerous zone when the actual people that are behind the protest are even requesting that you don't send money directly to them to show the other international companies that it's not actually funded. I call them companies more than countries in some instances. Because you don't want to show that the money is being funneled potentially from an outside source. And this is from the insiders inside of the square when it opened up after the tour opened up.
Hmm.
Yeah, they had requested that the money doesn't go in directly so that it doesn't look as if foreign interest is actually funding this peaceful revolution that is being called.
Yeah, I guess when you have 40% of the people uneducated that sort of have been propagandized to hate people who are not local, then any association with the West means that it's suspect, even if it's benevolent.
Now, get this. I just pulled up the lead story on CNN right now, and it says, galvanized by the emotional words of a freed Google executive, thousands of Egyptians jammed Cairo's Tahrir Square on Tuesday, dismissing the embattled regime's pledges of constitutional reforms.
Indeed, and that's part of the interesting part of it all, because there were several photos that have been leaked out that have come that show people with signs that are basically showing a free internet. They have the Internet Explorer symbol, the Google symbol, the Twitter symbol, the Facebook symbol, and then one other site. I can't recall it offhand. I believe it's Al Jazeera, because their offices were torched in Cairo. And they had all of those on one sign showing that, freeing all of this is in a way freeing the people. And they had basically taken the Google gentleman as a figurehead in the beginning as an organizer because of what he had did with Facebook, by starting the pages and really beginning the initial stages of rallying the organization for this movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see, like you just mentioned from the current feed, what the feedback was from the people in particular. On this instance of how this person who's seen as a martyr because he led the cause, but because he wasn't, killed, he's coming out as a revolutionary leader. And his words that he's speaking as far as, creating the actual freedom that's necessary for true communication between people of a country is really being heralded now at the moment as the leader of this particular peaceful movement. It's kind of a joy to see in a way.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you talking about Wael Gonen?
Exactly. Why is a man who he's the executive that got imprisoned, that very quietly, that part wasn't so led out that he was arrested in the beginning stages because too many people were focusing on the people amassing rather than a couple of the sidelines that kind of disappeared, and his was one of them. they kind of got lost in the lead lines.
Another issue that Anderson brought up, another reason why I thought it was dangerous now, was because the eyes of the world were not watching Egypt as closely. Because a lot of the reporters are leaving now as we move on to other world events.
Yeah, well, and they're leaving because they're being harassed, and it's very dangerous for them to be there, and because the news was pretty much the mass gathering, and now that the energy is dissipating, it's hard to put your finger on what's the news.
Well, and also going along those lines, I feel like part of the reason why the reporters are leaving is because Al Jazeera really has it covered. They have had this thing covered from the very beginning. And it's so funny because, you know, originally we had labeled them as some kind of terrorist organization several years ago, yet the whole world changed its mind when all of a sudden the only cameras that were actually on such a demonstration was particularly Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera English channel was the one that was really feeding the information to the rest of the Western world there for a while. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting how Anderson Cooper really made headlines for getting punched and a few other people being harassed, when I felt like, well, what do you expect? How can you not expect some kind of potentiality of a threat against yourself when you're in the middle of something that, first off, doesn't really have you as part of the saying, as part of what's going on in the country, yet you're going to go and report as an outsider on an insider thing? Now, with tensions flaring so much, you have to realize that that's going to be a potentiality when you put yourself in such a danger zone, theoretically, quote-unquote. So I found it really interesting that once it came out that it was undercover policemen that worked, that actually is who hit Anderson.
Yes.
Yeah, and they were reporting that. It's just kind of, I believe that the point of the movement got kind of lost when that became a headline. Because the headlines that really should have been going wasn't Anderson Cooper got punched. It should have been, in my mind anyways, that, you know, 300 people have died, thousands of people have been injured, yet this is being glossed over while we concentrate on Anderson Cooper getting punched once.
That's our nature of focusing on our people as being the center of the universe.
Hey, thanks a lot. Yeah. Should we keep talking about this after the break, Dr. Future?
If you like.
So, Michael, you going to hang on for us?
Sure, I'll hang on. Thanks.
If anybody else out there wants to watch what we're watching on the internet, you can go to ksco.com/Dr. Future and see what our links are at the moment. You could also go to drfutureshow.com.
Okay, we're back on the Dr. Future Show. We're just talking about the Egypt situation a little bit. I wanted to mention that I saw Dianne Feinstein this morning talking about our intelligence operations and their tracking of the Middle East. And she's in charge of a Senate subcommittee that oversees the intelligence organizations in this country. And she was saying that they had not one report about Egypt going off the deep end like this, that it just wasn't predicted.
So the intelligence gatherers are not looking at social change. They're not looking at the human function.
Well, they're just not telling Dianne Feinstein about it.
What do you think about that, Michael?
You know, the gat in itself is pretty interesting because it really comes down to, because you all have been covering WikiLeaks for a while, and I believe that that's kind of what happened, was that this was spurred from the momentum that was gained in Tunisia, which was based off of those cables that were released from WikiLeaks, which showed the irrefutable governmental fabrications.
Well, she said Tunisia was much more clearly delineated in the intelligence reports, but not Egypt. They didn't anticipate.
Right. Because people weren't expecting the inspiration to hit in a way that would actually allow them to make a movement. And because of Mubarak having such a grip on the country for 30 years, it's virtually impossible to make any movements against them, because any certain movement whatsoever against this gentleman landed you in prison. Or all of a sudden you disappeared. I mean, there were several additional leaders that have been in prison for years, including people who ran against him, theoretically speaking, but no one was really allowed to run against him because he had the right to change that.
Right. He was making up the rules.
Exactly,
and yet it still is remarkable to think that how could such a huge and seemingly well-organized movement in Egypt come out of the blue just because a week earlier something happened in Tunisia? Well, that just seems so incredible.
Well, people have neglected the actual importance of social networking, in the sense that once it's kind of the trickle-down effect or cause and effect. It's like one drop of water and all of a sudden the ocean's full, you know. So in this instance, what happened was one person sparked the idea. Wyatt, the gentleman, I'm sorry, his name, I'm saying it incorrectly.
His name is Wael Ghanim.
Thank you.
Sure.
So once that gentleman started the movement,
oh, no, I'm sorry.
It began to grow.
He's the Google guy.
He's the Google executive that started the Facebook movement for the change.
And then there was also videographers that were sending and spreading videos, and there was a specific woman who outed her name and has also been... There's many people,
Indeed. Oh, yeah, it wasn't one particular person.
Right.
But it takes one person to get the movement started.
And so this might go down as the first time in Facebook that a Facebook event created 300 martyrs in 2 weeks.
Well, that's true. I mean, but I think the one thing that really shouldn't be overlooked in this instance is that it was the cables from WikiLeaks that kind of indirectly started all of this, because it founded a movement in Tunisia that became successful. It gave hope and inspiration to other people that their movement would be inspirational and successful as well.
But what is success? I'm really just feeling so much compassion for all these people. And yet all of this violence and now all of these people being targeted as enemies of the government, how does this put people in charge?
Well, in this particular instance, I believe that there isn't an exact word success. You know, I hate that I used that earlier in success, but success was just in the meaning of organizing this movement. But the actual putting people in power and those kind of transitional things come down to the will of people and how strong that will will remain that these things need to happen. Now, the catch is, though, in this particular instance of Egypt happening, is that it has to be what the core of this is, that it has to be a peaceful demonstration, not in yet one more army military rise to remove a dictatorship. Which is part of why the military hasn't done anything in an instance, not just because of a lack of orders, but because even they themselves said we're not going to turn against the people as long as they remain peaceful.
So if we kind of use some of the statistics of history, I think it was like Lenin said that you only need to commit violence against 10% of the people to control the other 90% of the people. And so here we're saying that Mubarak is only going to be able to commit violence against a few hundred people, and that that isn't going to thwart the will of the united majority.
Indeed, and that is where the social networking in this instance comes into play the most by creating this movement, because they continue doing that with Tours, which is basically an informational network that gets passed along with a code key. And then whoever the recipient of the information is supposed to do through satellites, then they get the information coded on the other end.
Yeah, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, Michael.
Great.
Access Now, was it .org? Or is it accessnow.com?
I think it was a .org.
We talked about Tours and the ability for the people to get out on the internet via dial-up.
Right.
And now we're seeing, today I heard was one of the biggest demonstrations. It was the biggest demonstration that they've had to date.
And now you can also give me the question, is the social networks causing this evolution or is it facilitating it? I remember back in 1989, I was in Germany at the Berlin Wall. It was the August, just before it fell in October, I believe. And I was with Captain Crunch, one of the top hackers of the planet, and hanging out with the Chaos Computer Club. I had just written a book on computer viruses, and I was touring Germany. And I was there with some of the most well-connected hackers on the planet who were paying attention to Stasi communications in the East, and we were looking over the city of East Berlin from the West, and I asked them, do you think this will ever be one city? And they looked at me and they said, no, not anytime soon. Because it has separate electricity, separate governments, separate everything. And yet, 3 months later, the wall collapsed and they merged. So even the most connected radicals that I knew at the time did not have a clue what was coming down. So I don't think you can fully blame the intelligence agencies about this. I think social evolution has its mysterious path that still evades our ability to predict it.
Right.
I suggest that maybe that there's an element of that involved today, even though on hindsight you can kind of look at causal relationships.
Well, certainly there is a mysticism in its way of how revolution itself really works, because there's no real way to determine beginning systems. But what we can do these days is see how the information is spread, which in this instance, by using these social outlets, mm-hmm. They were able to create the word that needed to happen, which I'm really happy to say is part of the impetus of even more people today being out there.
Yes, it's a facilitation.
The will of the people.
Yeah.
Yes, the will of the people that refuse to be broken. Once the will begins, then it's impossible to end unless the people themselves change their minds.
And how interesting that the catalyst, in a way, was the WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps looking towards the future here, that the social media itself might become part of the fabric of a new way in which people organize their governments.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly believe that. Sure. That's with the way that this has moved here. That's undoubtedly a reasonable and plausible.
Yeah, I mean, we look, for example, we have direct democracy, possibilities of a direct democracy with everybody being able to weigh in from their cell phones on important issues. Things like that.
I also see this just being the tip of the iceberg with the WikiLeaks reverberations. We still haven't seen everything that's going to go down with the WikiLeaks.
And is it possible to have a truly transparent, open source type of organizational structure for a country
in this
day and age?
That's right.
Yeah.
When most governments work on secrets and lies.
Uh-huh.
And the transparency of it all is really going to be the most difficult thing for everyone. I mean, that's even how WikiLeaks moves everything through the Tor system with a key, because they know that even they can't be completely transparent with everything, because if they do, then there's more of a chance that things could be intercepted and changed and turned around towards a bias for someone else's agenda.
So there is a bill that has been, it's been an addendum to the Patriot Act. And there's a possibility that they may vote on there being a kill switch here in America.
I just Googled to find an article about it, and apparently the U.S. Congress is considering a bill called Protecting Cyberspace as a National Asset Act. If that isn't classic 1984 doublespeak, I don't know what is.
That's bad.
To protect it, you must kill it.
That's right. That's
indeed.
Right.
You must control it.
We are protecting the people who might have their secrets leaked.
So what can we do? What can we do as people? We have to write our senators. We have to tell them not to vote affirmative on this.
This, once again, comes into play of the will of the people. It comes down to how willing are we to actually take control of our own government in our own hands.
And how,
so that we really have that as an opportunity and an outlet and a plateau for our individualistic voices.
Yes. What's important there is an education of the people as well on these issues. Because how can people have intelligent conversations on this unless they know what this is about?
I have a bill number for this Protecting Cyberspace as a National Asset Act of 2010. It's bill number S-3480 in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just the name of that totally, you know, it takes you right back to the 80s and the fall of the wall and Reaganism jargon. It really does, in the sense of, well, let's give it a name, Freedom of Cyberspace is a National Asset Act. That right there just puts it into play of essentially what Egypt did. This bill, I've gone over it a little bit. I haven't had the opportunity to fully read it. What I see from it automatically is that essentially the way the kill switch is going to work is by the initial targets of the companies that control the internet, and then they have to stop it within a certain hour after the actual, it's like pushing a button, essentially. After the red phone rings, they have a certain time in which different aspects and zones have to be shut down. And then the entire grid has to be shut down by a certain time after that. And one of the things they're working on in this particular instance is even ending the possibilities of dial-up service because of how they're going to be interacting the internet lines through America.
Hmm.
So it's not just going through a Wi-Fi.
I guess chaos is way preferred over having clean lines of communication.
Well, precisely, especially for our freedom.
Right. Why would we want it to be completely killed? How would that be useful to the government to completely turn off the internet?
In a democracy where we're used to power and information being distributed and people doing their best to coordinate with as many people as harmoniously as possible.
Well, it takes us back to the divide and conquer, essentially, because what happens is it takes us back to a time where our communications weren't meant to be so instantaneous. So then they have the ability to suppress something that they're doing in a certain area for a certain amount of time before the information has to be released again.
Right.
Which gives them time to not only take care of whatever it is that they may or may not be doing, because I don't want to be, you know, such a subversive per se, because this is just a potentiality of why they're doing it. You know, but the thing is, once you're able to do that, then you have the ability to clean it up.
Sure, impression management.
Indeed, and in this particular instance, it's making sure that the will of the people remain in line with the government as opposed to the government being for the will of the people.
Hmm. Well, it's very interesting that trying to Google this bill today, I have just run into a complete stall on the internet. Like, I've been trying to Google it since we started talking about it, and it's just the little timer is going around and around, and I'm getting nothing.
Do not worry about it then.
Okay, yeah, maybe it's a clue. Yes, we should maybe move on. We have other things, I'm sure.
Anyway, Michael, thank you for
and,
your input.
Yeah, thanks
thank
a lot,
you.
And
certainly
anybody else? We'd love
and
to hear
your
call.
We have many other
call.
Stories to plug into here, so we'll do that now.
Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks
have
again.
A great day, Michael. Thanks for calling
you
in.
Thank you.
479-1080. KSEO.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We've been a bit political today, but that's the nature of the
Egypt,
times we're
yeah,
in.
Yeah, we're fascinated by what's going on in the Middle East. Yeah.
So the other thing related to this is that the former WikiLeaks employees have started their own leaks site. Apparently, some of the people that used to work for Assange have started their own site. They've kind of feel like he's just not the best conduit for some of the information that wants to get out there right now.
That's Julian Assange.
Julian Assange.
Yes, and the main guy behind the WikiLeaks. Who is this guy?
Julian. Well, he was on 60 Minutes last week. That's what they're trying to avoid with this new organization called OpenLeaks. They're trying to avoid the influence of a single figurehead by refusing to handle documents directly. Instead, they will act as a kind of a neutral conduit to connect leakers with media and human rights organizations.
Now, didn't we talk about OpenLeaks?
We mentioned it.
When WikiLeaks first came out and Julian Assange was in jail. And I think they started then, didn't they?
About a month ago.
Yeah.
I think we mentioned it.
Yeah.
But apparently it's been getting some traction. And OpenLeaks is a project that aims at trying to make whistleblowing a more safer and widespread thing.
And it says here that Assange is busy writing a book.
Yeah, I'm sure he is, in defending himself.
And can earn as much as $1.7 million.
Which will finance his organization.
Oh, okay.
But it's a figurehead. And we really don't have to have the celebrity in charge of things. You know,
well,
it's just that we've been programmed by our culture to think that way. In reality, a group organization can be much more powerful without having a figurehead. And that's what the OpenLeaks organization is trying to promulgate. It's all about the material, not about the personal life and the celebrity of the person in charge. It just gets so old to those that realize that there are many more things out there that can be accomplished without having that figurehead.
So did we learn this from the terrorists? Is this like the cell idea that you have these cells working all over the world and they're
It's funny, yeah,
connected?
You'd think we would learn by that, but no, we still have to focus on Osama bin Laden and things like that, you know?
Well, he's the celebrity there.
Yeah, right. What is this celebrityness? How absurd is that? It's real, right? It's what we do in this culture. We're a celebrity-driven culture. We take that seriously, no matter how ridiculous it is on another way of looking at it. It's still, that's what we do.
So, Dr. Future, yeah. how important do you think OpenLeaks is?
Well, I think it's worth trying. I think they won't accept or publish documents on their platform, but they'll create these digital drop boxes for members. And this process of submitting leaks is much safer and easier than before. It's less of a centrally controlled. It more reflects what's actually going on with the net in terms of lots of nodes everywhere. It's the same kind of thing.
So they're making it safe to be a whistleblower. That's their goal.
Yeah.
Not if they've got a big kill switch that can just turn it all off.
Well, there's that. But it's a member site. That's important.
I mark my words.
Dr. Future, you're saying it won't happen.
The kill switch is a ludicrous idea. You know, people may attempt to do that. But we already have the technology for building alternative internets almost overnight. You take down one internet, another one will pop up. It's not really a big deal anymore to create. It's getting easier and easier to build internets. You know, the technology is well understood. And can be seated. The idea of it is ridiculous. Actually, we are having were having cheap rockets to put internet satellites into space for a few million dollars. You could put in a half a dozen of them, and boom, you've got an instant global internet up again. That sort of thing is actually unfolding right now with the small little payloads from rockets. So if somebody tries to control the internet, it will just repeat itself. It's not based on any big labyrinthian technology that we can't control.
I sure hope you're right, Dr.
Yeah, that's...
Well, it is remarkable that it was designed to go around centralized information systems and to create a safety of having so many connections that it would be impossible to take out the center, you know?
Exactly. It's a decentralized... Well, it is actually has a lot of centralized control elements, but alternative networks can be created quickly. That's the operative...
Hallelujah.
It's sort of like the brain after a stroke, right? Yeah. It can reroute the information. It might not be as efficient or anything, but it can get there.
Yeah.
So what else is new in the news, Dr. Future?
Well, there's some very interesting news in the neurophysiology department that got my attention. You know, like how you're listening to the radio right now, you can actually listen precisely to frequencies of the brain right now, too. You can get right onto to the surface of the brain. And if you can put receivers right on the surface of the brain, you will see all kinds of activity going on that we're just beginning to look at as a whole. Like the brain has many what we call radio stations that are transmitting all the time.
Are we talking about non-invasive brain stimulation here?
No,
we're talking about invasive brain stimulation.
Very invasive.
This is with putting electrodes directly on the surface of the brain across it. We can actually pick up a three-dimensional matrix of radio signals that actually tell you a lot about what's going on that we had no idea. We used to be able to pay attention to EEGs and electroencephalograms, and we're able to tell basic things like states of awareness, whether you're awake or asleep or meditating. Things like that. And with these new techniques of monitoring the hundreds of, if not thousands of frequencies that the brain is generating every second, we're actually learning a lot about how we are working and how we're assembling reality from this.
So, Dr. Future, I put this up on the Sinocast in case anybody wants to see this beautiful picture of a brain. It looked like like filet mignon. They've got a grid of electrodes on this person's brain. With the skull cut off and...
Yeah, with these grids, you can watch consciousness fade under surgical anesthesia and return when the anesthesia wears off.
So we're watching the brain boot up and reboot.
That's right.
And turn off and...
Turn on as you ask different questions. You can see things occur and certain networks happen at very slow frequencies and don't change at all, no matter how deep you are under anesthesia. Others just go off right away. It's fascinating. It's like a whole matrix of information about... how we're assembling our experience of being alive every second.
And they're calling it electroorticography. Orticography. That's a hard word.
Electrocorticography. Cortography, probably.
And it's really a different way of doing study on the brain because they're recording brainwave data, as opposed to... electrical stimulation.
Brainwave data that's picked up from a distance, which is much less filled with information.
The electroencephalography, the EEG.
You can tell specific frequencies and combinations coming from different parts of the brain. It's a three-dimensional matrix of radio waves.
Oof. Why is this so interesting? What are we going to do with all of this data about the electricity of brains, the radio frequencies?
It tells you how the brain works, some little details like that, little things about which parts of the brain are involved with emotions, which parts are involved with cognitive thinking, which parts have to do with sleep, which parts have to do with your kidneys. Everything that's going on in your body is being regulated by the brain. And the brain has all this information about how it's running us going on there. And as we create our own robots and things like that, the information that we glean from this will be tremendously useful, especially if we want to ever augment our memories, for example, with new memories or other languages. If we want to be able to learn a language, we have to know how language is being encoded in these frequencies, how memories are encoded in frequencies. And once we figure out the neural code, we'll be able to interface with it
Mm-hmm. Oh, so this is kind of in the same school as like the Neurophone Tech, where Dr. Flanagan's device actually recorded how to hear from the electrical signals of what was being heard, as opposed to the physical sound sensations. So this is...
Yeah, this is a way more complex, but yeah, along those lines.
I think that there's even more closer, more practical, like immediate understanding.
Yeah, medical
that
uses.
Would help.
And like, like how seizures work.
How seizures work, how when one of the biggest problems or challenges with people that have brain surgery or have brain procedures is they have to put them into a comatose state while they're working on the person, depending, of course, on obviously some of the brain procedures don't need that. And so when the person comes out of the coma state or is unable to come out of the coma state post-operation, this will give us the information to better understand and help those people come back out. If we understand how the brain boots up or reboots up.
Look, they rebooted, but the amygdala didn't come up. Be able to see how
or people
how well they
rebooting up and not being able to swallow and having to relearn how
you
to
see
walk
which system,
and talk.
And you can maybe just reboot that system. The other element here is the feedback loop, the biofeedback interface, whereby you give yourself conscious awareness of your own processes, and then you can use the feedback loop by seeing how what you actually are doing, you can then modify it.
That's the beauty of the study, is that biofeedback work has been going on for many, many years, and people really do think it's a ha-ha, hippy-drippy thing, and that this could actually lead us to understanding that biofeedback work, where you help somebody maybe who is a little hyperactive maintain their brain state, that helps them calm down and be able to go into a concentrated state so that they can work better in school. And talking about those little kids that don't have to go on Ritalin but can actually train their brains.
Well, if you take the time to learn what you actually are doing and to tune into your own system, that's what it takes. It takes the intention for you to learn this, much like you would learn reading, writing, or arithmetic. There is an attention process that our educational system just hasn't really supported yet. But if we do, we'll be able to learn how to be more conscious of our bodies and our minds and optimize their functionality and health. So
there you go, Mrs. Future. That's why we should be paying attention.
I'm telling you, this is going to be such a weird world in the future. We're going to be wearing all of these devices, and they're going to be telling us who we are because somehow we forgot. And
remember the Intel futurist? He said that the future is sensors and putting up sensing data and getting as much information from everywhere.
You know how I've really let myself relate to it is this idea that we're not getting encroached upon by all of these machines. We're actually expanding an individual's breadth of reach, you know, by having these enhanced sensibilities. There's more to you. It's not like there's less of you because you have technology enhancing your memory or because you are using biofeedback to learn how to improve your...
All right. Well, here's something even easier to do. How about certain frequencies when you stimulate? You could give yourself certain frequencies. It's been now shown that in the anterior temporal lobes, that if you stimulate yourself with specific frequencies, you actually increase your creativity several hundred times. You're able to solve problems more effectively. Again, suggesting that states of consciousness that can be induced in various ways, not just chemically, but through electrical stimulation, you're able to get into creative states and solve problems.
So is this better than making love?
It's besides that, little hippy-dippy here. This is beyond love, my dear.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the inventors that I've met over the years that are very successful and able to invent new problem-solving solutions know how to get themselves into the alpha state or the beta state, that they know how to stimulate themselves to get into that brainwave state so that they can solve the problem.
Yeah, and have that sudden insight.
And that a lot of times it has to do with doing something that your body can do repetitively without having to engage the brain too much.
Sure.
And allow the brain to be free, such as swimming laps, driving. A lot of inventors.
Mantras in the old school. Yeah. Just chanting the same thing over and over again until you're not really thinking about it.
Hey, Dr. Future, what's up in the second half of this?
Well, we're going to get into the future of education and learning a little bit with the library situation. We're going to tie it in with an understanding of what's going on with libraries in our own community. There's some controversy happening here that I think might apply on a larger scale.
Okay, next hour we're going to be looking at Santa Cruz.
And beyond.
And hopefully hearing from Pastor Steve DeFields Gambrill of the Circles Church. We're hoping he gives us a call. Stay tuned. KSCO 1080.
Dr. Future.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show, our second hour. We have a little conversation about the library system that we'll be discussing in a few minutes. But first, there is an interesting event happening this Saturday night. I wanted to mention Mrs. Future is involved with this, and it's involved in a rather interesting alliance between Native American elders and the Santa Cruz community for creating a live concert. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. What we have happening is a concert and a silent auction that's hosted by a local organization called the Thousand Hummingbirds. And the Thousand Hummingbirds is a group of women that are local activists and Native people all over the country that have put together a four-year program of annual gatherings to work for purification of water. And they're holding a benefit concert here at the Internet Ministries Saturday night at 7 p.m.
Be singing?
Yes. There's going to be Alice DeMasile, who is a songwriter and a wonderful performer. And there will also be Native women drumming. There's storytelling. There's sacred song and sound healing. And there will also be a presentation of a really interesting water project where kids, there's basically, it's an African organization, or it's an international organization putting in water pumps in Africa that are designed to look like kids' merry-go-rounds.
Oh, I've seen those. Yeah, those
yeah.
Are cute.
And yeah. So the kids jump on these merry-go-rounds, and as they play, it pumps water up to a community holding tank. It just creates a clean water system that can be used by everybody in the village. And they put these things near schools, and it allows kids to play. And it's really changing a lot of the way that people can have access to water.
I would say turning fun into water.
Yeah.
And the energy of fun.
Thousand Hummingbirds, again, it starts at 7 p.m. And the address is 5630 Soquel Drive in Soquel at the Inner Light Ministries. It starts at 7. Actually, the silent auction, if you want to get there for the fundraiser part of it, will start around 6:30. And
what are they raising money for?
They're raising money for this program of installing water pumps. And also for the
merry-go-round water pumps.
Yeah, merry-go-round. And just for their activities to raise consciousness about the water and to activate projects that bring water to places.
So it's all about the water.
It's all about the water.
It's the water from the Native point of view.
That's right.
Now, is it any particular group of Natives, or is it a combination of different Native communities?
Well, the local Ohlone people are very involved with it, but it's tribes from all over the country.
Mm-hmm. And the cultural creatives of Santa Cruz helping to pull this off.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so the
Inner Light Ministry.
Inner Light Ministry, okay.
Yes,
good.
In Soquel. And there's a Facebook page for people who are on Facebook. If you look for an event called A Thousand Hummingbirds, then you will find all of the data.
Great. All right, thank you.
All right, Dr. Future, we've got a couple phone calls here. The first person we're going to bring up here is Pastor Steve DeFields Gambrill of the Circles Church. Mm-hmm. Now, tonight, the Santa Cruz City Council is going to be having a meeting, and they're going to be talking about libraries. And specific task force has given us some different ways of approaching keeping our libraries healthy.
Yeah, from what I understand, there's a couple of different visions for the county system. One is that keeps all 10 branches open as community gathering places, and the other that shutters 4 of the branches to deal with the economic issues.
Yeah, I believe there's 4 different...
There's 4 now? Okay.
There were four proposals.
There are 4 models. And so Reverend Steve was a great advocate last year, no, actually in 2008. Well, let's just bring him on and he can talk for himself. Good afternoon, Reverend Steve.
Hi, Reverend
Steve. Good afternoon.
Yeah. For our audience, could you help tell us what the basic issue is right now with the libraries? They're in danger of being shut down?
Well, the basic issue is money. It's always money. Yeah. The library is struggling for money, and the library feels like that, you know, one of the more expensive items on their budget that they don't think is necessary is to have as many branches as we have for Santa Cruz County. Uh-huh. And, of course, at the neighborhood level here, we feel like the branches are for the kids and that a lot of our children are not going to be able to get on a bicycle and ride their bicycle downtown to read books if we close the branches. And so that's the essence of the debate right there.
Uh-huh. So you see these as these community gathering places for the kids are a good place for the kids to gather and to learn about things and read books and do things.
Exactly. That's some of my best memories of childhood are getting on my bicycle and riding to my local branch library and spending the afternoon reading and meeting up with other kids. Mm-hmm. You know, the front lines of our struggle against street gangs is got to be to provide wholesome options for our kids other than gangs and other unhealthy things to do. So this is just shooting ourselves in the foot as a community to close the branches where kids hang out in healthy ways and learn healthy values.
And so how does this work out, Reverend? Is there a way that all of these libraries can stay open? And what do people have to do if that's what they would like to see happen?
Well, communities have to step up to it. I agree with the library board and with our head librarian that radical change is needed. The library system can't continue to function under the kind of funding assumptions that they've used for years. But instead of trying to kill our branches, I think the library board needs to open up and encourage and try to create radical community partnerships to keep branches open with a lot of volunteers and with a lot of partnerships with maybe other community groups as well. One of the models supposedly takes that into account, and Model C tries to keep all the branches open, but it's a very expensive model, and I think that the reason that shows up as so expensive is because they greatly underestimated the value of volunteers. I think we can save a lot more money than Model C's projected budget shows if we really recruit our communities to volunteer and keep our libraries open as community centers. There are just some assumptions about volunteers that are built into that Model C that just, I think, really underestimate what we can get out of volunteers.
So, Reverend Steve, can you tell us a little bit about what are the different models? From what I understand, the county has overwhelmingly been supportive of our libraries. Measure B in 1996 was voted at 72.3% for a sales tax to mm-hmm. keep our communities open. And then Measure R again in 2008 was overwhelmingly voted in by 73% of the voters for making Measure B sales permanent. And yet it seems like all the time we have to have these save our libraries. Like, what is going on?
Well, it seems to me like the library system, what is going on is that they keep assuming that the only way to save the library from some financial crisis is to close the branches. I believe they're not hearing what the voters said in those two votes. They made those votes because they wanted their branches to be open. I think in a lot of the voters' minds, when they cast their ballot, they were thinking about their local branch.
I know.
So to go ahead and close the branches is sort of a betrayal of those votes.
Yeah, and the money that we set aside and promised to put for the sales tax, where's that money going to?
I'm not real sure.
I'm very confused by this. And so they're having a city council meeting tonight.
Yes, they are. And one of the real concerns is that the city council is apparently talking about directing. There are two representatives on the Library Powers Board from the city council. And the council is talking about directing those two members to vote what the city council tells them to vote when they go to the Library Powers Board meeting, which I think really, you know, is not appropriate. They don't need to tie the hands of those two members of the Library Powers Board. They need to let them make the decision they need to make.
Which I'm hoping is listen to the voters.
I think so. There are four models. Two of the four models close several branches. One of the four models technically keeps some branches open, but they make them into specialty branches that aren't really available for young people and for community centers. And then one model, of course, that shows up as the most expensive one keeps them all open, and that's the one they don't really want to do. But I still say they underestimated the cost savings from using volunteers. I don't think the Library Powers Board grasps how, if they would let us, how strongly the community would rally and partner with the library staff to keep these branches open with a lot more volunteerism and a lot more community activism.
And so if people were to go to the city council tonight and make a stand, What is it that they should be asking the city council to do? Be real clear, because it's a little confusing. It's not real direct.
Well, I think the first thing they need to ask the city council to do is to not tie the hands of their representatives, not to direct the representatives to vote in any one way or the other. That allows us to go on to the Library Powers Board meeting and have an honest discussion and an honest public feedback with the Library Powers. If the city council votes to direct their representatives tonight, then the story's pretty well over tonight.
So
that's really usurping the public process.
My understanding is then you're saying that we need to give the community our right to have a public process.
Exactly.
And that the city is kind of usurping that power by making a decision tonight, and we don't want them to do that.
And they're jumping the gun. The other thing I would ask the city, and I will be asking the city council to consider, is to consider the possibility that, I don't want to say this too in too hostile a way, but I think unintentionally, I think Model C, the books have been cooked to make that look more expensive than it has to be.
I see.
I believe if the Library Powers Board went back to Model C with some different assumptions about what could be done with volunteers, they'd have an affordable Model C that keeps all the branches open.
Is there a Facebook page or there's somewhere else that we could get more information? I know that the Sentinel had an article in today's paper about this.
The Sentinel had an article in today's paper. There's two groups that I know of. One is working on saving the Felton branch in particular, and then there's one that's working on saving the Garfield branch as well. I don't know if I want to come up with the Facebook page quickly enough for you, but you can definitely go to the City of Santa Cruz website, and you can find the task force report that the City of Santa Cruz, the City Council, will be looking at, which outlines exactly what the four different models will do.
Now, Reverend Knight, I wanted to ask you, if we can just step back from this for a moment and really look at the evolution of libraries, where do you see them going in this day and age where we all have personal computers and iPhones and iPads, and we have access to the thousands of books from wherever we are, from our mobile devices? Why do we need to have a library? Or why not just social centers with some books or some iPads that people can connect to? Why does it? Maybe they do need to be radically revised, given the shifting in how information is being delivered in our culture.
Oh, I think libraries do need to be radically revised. But I think the radical revision doesn't necessarily mean a centralizing. I think that's the 20th century model, is to revise in the direction of centralizing everything in one place. I think with the modern technologies, what we can do is we can do more and make a great deal more available in branches where people can access them and make each of those branches into a real community center.
So one of the things, a social space then.
That's right. It's right. And that's one of the reasons why I think that I recognize that the Library Powers Board, with the money they have available, have a real problem keeping these branches open.
Yeah.
That's why I think that the branches function at least half as a community center and half strictly as a library with books and literacy-related activities. And so I think that the community and community groups need to rally and be created to partner with the Libraries Board and take some of the burden of keeping these branches open. I don't think we can just go to the Library Powers Board and say, don't close our branches. I do agree that we need to rally and say, here's an alternative to closing our branches, and we'll step up to the plate and we'll help keep them open.
Mm-hmm. And you believe that the public process in the next couple of weeks between now and, I guess, on the 14th is the end of the public process?
Yes.
And so you think just that little bit of extra time, one more week, will be enough to make enough of a shift in the way that people are talking about organizing and spending the money that it would be worth doing this option of keeping all the libraries open?
Let me rephrase that, nuance that just a little bit more, if I could. I think that we need to take the time and we need to make the effort. I think the Library Powers Board, if the Library Powers Board would say to us in the local neighborhoods, we are open to ideas. We're open to community groups partnering with us to keep these things open. As long as we don't have to foot the entire financial bill, we can't afford to keep doing that. Then I think if we gave that option some time, because it's going to take time to rally communities. It's going to take time to form groups and organizations and get a structure in these local neighborhoods to shoulder some of the weight of keeping these branches open in terms of staffing and labor and so forth. But if they give us a little time and they said we're open to that, I think our communities would. I know, last year when this whole issue came up about a year and a half ago, the number of people that were rallying to keep the branch open was just amazing, and the amount of commitment and energy that came around that, if those folks, each of them would volunteer a few hours every week, we'd have plenty of people to staff that branch.
Yeah, there you go.
Great.
You know, I think, honestly, and, you know, don't hold me to these numbers, but I think if the library would give us a half a day of a librarian to train and sort of coordinate, we could keep that branch open from there on. Give us a half of 1 day of library staff support, and we'll keep the branch open.
Cool.
in the Gulfview Park branch. That's what I think could happen.
We need to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors, KSCO 1080.
Welcome back to the Dr. Feature Show with Reverend Steve on the library situation here in Santa Cruz County. We have some callers. Reverend, would you like to hold on while we take them?
Sure.
Great.
Okay, you want to bring the first one up?
Yeah, but didn't you have a question, Dr. Future?
Yeah, I think one of the things to consider on this is the type of social space that is compatible with libraries, because there are many social spaces that our kids would enjoy.
Yeah, and I keep seeing you holding your Kindle going, why do I need a library I've got a Kindle in my hand?
Well, Kindle, yeah. I think one of the things that I certainly appreciated as a library as a kid was the quiet, the ability to delve deeply into a subject, to explore interests in a more profound way than you can in many social spaces.
All right.
Well, if you went to the Garfield Park branch of the library, you would see a lot of kids, not necessarily with their nose in a bound book. They're on their computer, they're online, doing their homework, doing research for term papers. There's a lot of activities besides just opening up an old-fashioned bound book and reading it that's going on at the library branches now. But it is that quiet space where a love of learning is the central focus.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. That's the compatible social space.
The ancient reason why we started with libraries as a place of the production of knowledge.
That's right.
So we've got Joni in from Felton. Welcome, Joni.
Thank you, Nada. Thank you, Dr. Future. I'm really glad you're talking about this topic. It's super important and really time critical. A couple things I wanted to say is I do know the links for how to get a look at that task force report. Pastor Steve had mentioned the Felton Library Groups. Their website is feltonlibraryfriends.org. That's all one word. Also, to see the complete task force report, you can go to the library website, santacruzpl.org, and there's a place where you can click on final report.
What was that again? Santa Cruz?
It's the library's website, santacruzpl, for public library, .org.
Okay.
And then on the home page, there's a section where it says happening at the library during February, and then you'll see something you can click on that says final report under the task force on financially sustainable library service models. Also, the city council has it on as a link on their agenda on the webpage, but that brings up something that I want to mention just in a moment, which is that the library director created her own introduction to that task force's report on the city council's agenda, and she's got some skewed information in there, which I find really troubling, you know, that it was clear that she was trying to bias it in the direction of one of the four options and against one of the other ones. And hopefully the city council members will hopefully be intelligent enough to see through that. But I'd like to touch on maybe some of those points later. Three other things I'd like to say first. Number one, on the issue of this being an expensive model, actually, the task forces, they were tasked with coming up with a financially viable model for the future of the library. That was their job. They came up with four separate financially viable models. Each one is a financially viable model. So I really want to emphasize this. This was because in the past, they kept saying, the library board, we don't know if we can afford to keep these branches open, and they kept threatening to close it, and the community repeatedly with Measure R, with the town hall meetings the library had, with library use surveys, we kept saying, we want libraries nearby. So finally they said, okay, we'll create a task force. We won't close you yet. We'll create a task force to see if we can afford to keep the libraries open. And this is the really, really troubling thing, that they've come up with two models that keep the libraries open. There's really only one that keeps all the branches open as regular, fully staffed branches with normal circulation. I think another model keeps the branches open, but maybe some of them have specialized collections, and they only are allowed to be open if they have volunteers to keep them open in those hours. But anyway, I'd like to say that option C, which is the one that those of us who support having our neighborhood branch is protected, that option is a financially viable option. Every single one of the four is. And so we were very thrilled that they came up with an option that said, yes, you can keep your neighborhood branches open. We can afford this. But what the debate's getting into is it's turning into a question about what should our library be. And the other model that many members, it seems like there's a bit of a split on the library board, with a lot of them supporting this neighborhood branch, and then maybe almost an equally, frighteningly equal number of them supporting the opposite, the Model D. Model D would close the four smaller neighborhood branches. So, for example, within the city of Santa Cruz, only the central branch library would be an option. People wouldn't have anything on the west side. They wouldn't have Branch of 40 over in the Seabright neighborhood. So everyone's going to be going through the downtown, finding parking, getting through traffic to get into the central library. That's going to be Santa Cruz City families' experience of the library now, instead of their little neighborhood libraries, if option D is chosen. Mm-hmm. So,
in this day and age of the internet, why not have a decentralized model?
Why not have a decentralized model? Right. Well, again, yeah, you're looking at what is a library. Is a library...
Yes.
I'll tell you what I saw in a library this afternoon. I was just at the Felton Library. I walked in, and it was a beautiful scene. There was a 90-year-old man and his woman, and his wife, checking some books out. And then there was, you know, there were four different families, moms with little kids who were there, you know, reading books with them. They were getting ready to go pick up the older kids at school. There were people busily on the internet using that. It was a vibrant and full place. It's part of the fabric of our community. And I think that that's really what we need to be thinking about, is this quality of life, the future of what we want our community to look like and feel like.
Yes, exactly. Well, what is the social learning space of the future like? You know, what does it look like, and how can we get there from
and
here?
And how do we create a sense of what our community is, our loyalty to each other and our branding? And I believe that's with a presence in our neighborhoods. The outcry from Felton was huge at the meeting last night. We had maybe 50 people, half of whom spoke up. And it's because it's a demonstration of what the power of a library is in a community. It created us as a community, a group of people who love it, who that's part of what we do during our day or our week or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we are loyal to it. We were a huge part of why Measure R passed. The library would not have the funding it does today if it weren't for the loyal, unincorporated county library users who were passionately out there trying to get people to tax us so that we could pay to keep our neighborhood branches open. So we said, yes, tax us. We said, yes, we'll come up with a task force. Yes, do a task force. And every time they keep saying, okay, I mean, this time they're like, okay, yeah, we could conceivably keep your branches open, but gosh, do we really want to do that, or do we want to close you, take that money, and then go have a bunch of big screen stuff happening in a techier, flashier central area? And the other thing to keep in mind when you're talking about future is sustainability. Mm-hmm. Do we want people in their cars more, mm-hmm. or do we want us in our cars less? Right now, kids ride their bikes to the Garfield Park branch. Someone was talking last night about how you see 8-year-old, 10-year-old kids that have come there on their bikes after school, teenage girls. And they said to go to the central downtown branch, it's not safe and okay for the kids to do it, the younger ones. And the teenage girls, this woman said, they don't want to have to go through the gauntlet of people that are loitering outside the library.
Sure, yeah.
And so it's really a question of our priorities in our community, and it's a question of fairness too. I have to say flat out that we are in these neighborhoods around the smaller branches paying exactly the same taxes as everyone else. Mm-hmm. And to suggest that we should not have, that they should take away something that we are paying for, and particularly when we passed Measure R, it said the measure said that it was to emphasize and help protect keeping neighborhood libraries open. So I really wonder if that's even legal. And I guess technically it must be, but it certainly isn't the spirit of the law to pass a measure that says it's going to do one thing and then threaten to take away exactly what we all voted to do and are paying for.
Well,
thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate
thanks, Joni. We got Nancy calling. Hey, have a great day.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Okay.
Let me call.
Nancy. Education on this topic.
Hey, Nancy, thanks for calling in.
Hi. I just wanted to reiterate everything that Joni said. I was a little disturbed on the how Model C was described, and I don't think it was quite understood. Model C is financially sustainable. All the models may have a bit of trouble, though, given the spike in health care and benefits that the city of Santa Cruz is anticipating. And I know that's a big subject on their agenda that's going to be talked about in the next few months, and that will affect all of the models one way or another. But I do want to say that all four models are financially sustainable, projected out over 5 years. So that once you accept that, and that is in the report, then you have to start looking at the details. Model C had the approach that volunteers, to have a branch dependent on volunteers to open its doors, was not a great idea, because sometimes volunteers don't show up, or sometimes something happens, or they're not employees, so they're not bound to. And I love volunteers. I'm a volunteer myself.
It's just not as reliable. Yeah,
that's right. Well, yeah. I think they are reliable, but sometimes things happen. And besides, why should a community be responsible for recruiting people in their community to staff a library that they're already paying for through taxes? So that's the basic philosophy there. And Measure R, several times in the voter pamphlet, it uses the phrase support of existing local public libraries. Existing local public libraries. This is reiterated again and again. And then it names the libraries, all 10 of them. So it's pretty clear in that. And the arguments that were signed in favor of Measure R were signed by Gail Ortiz, George Au, Mary Hammer, Dan Halfley, Mary Lou Gecky, Karen Delaney, Bruce McPherson, Robert Locatelli. All these people signed the arguments in favor of Measure R. And in one of the arguments, it says, fact, Measure R funds programs, books, and electronic resources for, in capital letters, every branch library. And then it names the 10, well, actually, it names all the branches plus Watsonville, because Measure R is a quarter-cent sales tax. And the money is divided proportionately in terms of population between the Santa Cruz Public Library System and the Watsonville Public Library System. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay, good. I just put up the different models on our website here so people can check that out for detail.
So if you have any questions about the models, I might be able to answer them. But I think it's important that people really understand. And, for instance, Garfield Park needs to understand that if the other 10-branch model is Model B, and if Garfield Park went with Model B, basically Model B turns Garfield Park into a genealogy and history branch with a small browsing collection. It means that there still has to be a volunteer there to open the doors. And it's not a very big branch. I've been in the branch. It's, 200 square feet or something. So assuming genealogy would want to move there, there wouldn't be all that much room left for kids, computers, that type of thing.
Yeah. So do you have your opinion as to what the future library would be like?
I think the future of public libraries is really bright. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we move into the future, people want to connect. You know, and you can tell by...
So having the social space is an important component, then you would agree with that, huh?
I think having a physical space is a very important component, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, people like to connect on Facebook and virtually and all that.
Yeah.
The truth is, they like to hang out with each other, too. and children, I honestly don't see children sitting in front of their own individual Kindles. I think sharing books is something that's not going to go away. In my lifetime, I have no idea about 50 years from now, but so I'm really grounded in the present of what I see right now and what I see all over the country for public libraries.
So for the immediate future, this is a really good idea to keep these local branches open and
absolutely.
To encourage the kids to socialize with each other, an important part of growing up.
Yeah, the public libraries across the country are thriving.
Yeah. Great.
All right. And we have one more call. Thanks a lot, Nancy. Have a great day. Thanks for calling in.
Okay, you too.
This is Alex in Santa Cruz. Welcome, Alex.
Oh, Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think this conversation is awesome. I just turned on the radio on my way home from work, and I want to thank KSEO for having this conversation. I didn't even know this was going on. Me and a few of my friends use the resource of the library. It's just awesome to be able to go there and use the computers and rent videos, and they got awesome music there, too. And I think a lot what you guys are talking about in the future, like everyone having computers and stuff, I'm just over the last few years gotten a better job to where I've been able to get a computer and stuff, but most of the people I know don't have computers.
So the library is the place where you can get access to online and to connect with each other about what you're learning.
Yeah, I mean, the access to Kindles and iPads, I mean, living in Santa Cruz, I think a lot of times we kind of get a distortion on the social reality, you know, in our country or even in the state. I know a lot of people don't have the resources. I don't know if there's statistics out there, like how many people have computers or access to the internet, but I don't think a lot of people do, and I think these social places are like awesome resources for especially people in the lower income brackets.
Yeah.
We have a big group of those people in Watsonville.
Yeah.
I think these resources are just awesome places for people to be introduced to this kind of stuff, and I mean, in the future, I hope there'd be more places like this, because in reality, I mean, it'd be nice if we all could have an iPad, but I don't know if that's really the reality we are going to be able to see.
You think it'd be nice if the libraries had lots of iPads you could use while you were there?
I think it's trivial, and I think, you know, the access to information is basically the most important.
So, iPads, any computer terminal, I mean, the idea that the computers are available at the library, would you say that's important?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's amazing. Just over the last few years, I've been getting into computers because I've been able to afford it now. But it's amazing the amount of information out there, and I know a lot of people that they wouldn't even be able to access that stuff if it wasn't for the library and the resources that provides. And I just want to thank KSDO for having this conversation. I think it's an awesome conversation, and hopefully we'll keep the libraries open.
All right. Well, thank you for being part of the conversation. Appreciate
it. What was that website you said that you guys have the
if you want to get the future of libraries, we've got some links on our Twitter feed. Let me
DrFutureShow.com.
DrFutureShow.
Go to there.
Twitter.
Yeah.
We got another 30 seconds.
Okay,
hey, thanks a lot, Alex. Have a great day.
Well, thanks.
We still have Reverend Steve on the line.
We do, Reverend. Yeah, I hope you got all that conversation.
Stay tuned, and we'll have a last talk with Reverend Steve and some other stories too.
All right. BeltonLibraryFriends.org and SantaCruzPL.org.
Right, we're back on Dr. Future.
Okay. Any final thoughts, Reverend, before we change topics here?
Well, just one brief one. I appreciated what everyone else that called in said, and I want to reiterate, the one caller was right. All of these models are presented because they're financially viable for the future of the library over a five-year period, and that's true. The reason I think there's such a concern and such a movement to still close some branches is because that is the cheapest of the four financially viable models. Then my point is that the most expensive of the four financially viable models is Model C, which keeps all branches open. But I think they still think they underestimated some of the ways we can save costs and still do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has to be the most expensive of the four choices anyway.
All right. Okay. So we want people to come out to the city council meeting tonight at 7 o'clock. Is that right, Reverend?
That's right, because really if they decide to direct their representatives to vote in a certain way, that could be the end of the story tonight. It could be all over tonight.
Okay.
And we don't want that to happen. We want a chance for the community to continue to have a conversation about this.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for calling, Reverend Steve. Hope we can have you back on sometime.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, keep us posted of any change.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to repeat those links for people who want to read up a little bit on these things. Go to the City Council meeting prepared. That's FeltonLibraryFriends.org and Santa Cruz PL, like public library, SantaCruzPL.org.
Okay. Now,
well, thank you for that, Mrs. Future. I was going to do that myself.
Yeah, get those links out there.
We want people to know where to go. And of course, you could also always go to ksco.com/Dr. Future, and you will get to see the simulcast of all of the different internet stories that we've been talking about today.
Exactly.
And then the DrFutureShow.com, where you can get an archive of all the past shows that we've done.
You can catch up with what we're doing. I highly recommend our links page. If you don't have time to listen to the show, the links page has a lot of the stories that we've discussed. If you want to know more about them, then you can listen to the show.
And not to leave out our Twitter feed, Dr. Future Show. You can Twitter and read all the tweets.
Yeah, and it's at the drfutureshow.com site.
The way to revolution, Twitter.
Now, another thing, in terms of the education, the future of libraries, a couple of interesting stories. One of the great things about Google is that people can come up with an idea one day, and the next day they can start to work on it and make it a reality. And that's what's happened with the art project. It's a new tool that puts 1,000 works of art at your fingertips in extraordinary detail.
Huh.
It started with a group of Googleites who were passionate about art. They got together to think about how they might use this technology to help museums make their art more accessible. And not just regular museum goers, but people who might be at home and want to get a chance to see the real thing up close. Or in other libraries. Imagine at a library you'd have a nice video projection system where you have an art teacher come in and take you on a tour of some of the best paintings of our species.
Well, just the other day, I was looking at a virtual tour of the Sistine Chapel, where you could see in 360 degrees all the floor, go up, zoom into the different paintings on the ceiling. You get almost a better experience than going to Rome.
Exactly. And I can imagine, you know, somebody who knows a lot about it, a curated experience that could be happening in the libraries, where this could be something that the kids can learn about firsthand.
And it doesn't take much. I was just doing this the other day at Bayview Elementary. We had five little computers loaded up with all the same images. Everybody got to see it. Everybody was talking about it.
Mm-hmm. And there you go.
There you go.
This is the GoogleArtProject.com. And here you'll find a selection of super high-res images of famous works of art, more than 400 artists all in one place. And they use the Street View technology.
For paintings.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how many of you have experimented with Street View, but if you go into Google Maps and you hit Street View, you can actually tootle along various roads and look at your own house. The Google van or bicycle even has gone by your place. Now you can do that with great art. A virtual tour inside 17 of the world's most acclaimed art museums.
It's fabulous. Instead of having to fly to the Louvre to Paris, France, we could just get online and go to a URL.
The Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Met, the State Hermitage Museum, the Big Hermitage in St. Petersburg.
Hermitage, yes.
The National Gallery in London.
And what's really exciting is if you see somebody like Vincent van Gogh, you can't get the amazing depth of the paintings when you see it in a book or a poster. There's such thickness and there's so much vibrancy that's added to the paintings, specifically Van Gogh's, by how his art brush technique added. And you can get that now because you really get to see these paintings up close.
Oh, big time. Each of the 17 museums selected one piece of art to be photographed in extraordinary detail using super high-resolution gigapixel photo-capturing technology. And each of these images have about 7 billion pixels. That's 1,000 times more detailed than your average digital camera. And a specially built microscope view using Picasa to deliver these images in these high resolutions.
And
zoom in. You can look at the brush strokes, as Nada was saying.
And literally look at it better than if you're there. Like, they've got the picture of Botticelli's The Birth of Venus from the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, Italy. And there's railings. You don't get to go up close to these paintings. And if you do, let me tell you, those guards are on you in a second. I've had it happen to me many a time. And all you got to do is it's Google Art Project, and you'll find it.
And this is Google's first step towards creating great art being more accessible. It's just the beginning, folks, of this kind of thinking.
Just like they've been digitizing books for many, many years now, going in and I know up at UCSC they got special collections, they get their archive, and they're photocopying these so that we'll be able to access them on the internet.
Yes, yes. So if you're a student or an aspiring artist or a casual museum goer, you know, this project should bring you a lot of fun and interesting ways to interact with art and hopefully inspire you to see the real thing one day.
Knowledge is power, Dr. Future.
And speaking of museums and libraries, did you know that the Ronald Reagan Museum just opened a state-of-the-art... Actually, excuse me, it's not a museum, it's a library.
Isn't it reopening?
Reopening, yeah, upgraded. Upgraded to a whole new level of functionality. And one of the things that it has is over 250 iPads
that you get to check out when you go there.
Yeah.
And you walk around with an iPad and it explains it to you and you get to like go into detail.
I'm not sure how mobile they are. I think they're part of exhibits that are going on at the museum. We'll have to see. But it's down in Simi Valley, and it's supposed to be one of the latest state-of-the-art libraries on the planet, that using all the new technologies for exploring the whole Ronald Reagan legacy.
Well, Dr. Future, there was a article on This American Life just a few weeks ago about the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley and how they have many interactive, performative pieces for education for children. And so you as the child get to go there and act like you're Ronald Reagan and get to pretend and have your presidential cabinet and look to them for helping answer questions. And in fact, they had a mock trial of the invasion of Grenada. And this little boy, if he had been Ronald Reagan, we would not have invaded.
Oh, I see. So you get to kind of like the holodeck in Star Trek.
Eh? Exactly.
You get to act out your own scenario. You can be on the bridge.
Yeah. You get to be Ronald Reagan.
You can be the president. You
can
be the captain.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, that'd be good training for the kids.
That's where it's going.
It'd be fun for any of us, actually.
Now, I've driven by many a time the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, but have yet to go in there, which I think is a shame, and I should.
Okay. Well,
only because my sister lives down the road from it. But
which one? Nixon Library?
The Nixon Library.
I've been there.
And?
It was pretty amazing. I was there when Nixon was still alive. We were having a big party in the museum, actually.
You were having a party in the Nixon Library?
Yeah, he was, he almost came.
Hey, that's something you can't have virtually, huh?
No, we had, it was sponsored by Pixar and Lucasfilm. And they set up a giant projection screen overlooking the reflecting pool, and we had all kinds of wild visuals, live music. It's really interesting because they have a long hallway which you walk through, and you can see Nixon's original Woody car that was used for campaigning in the 50s, and it was amazing.
Good old Dick.
Yeah, and it looks like, but our crew was there, and it's like, we finally won. We were partying in the Nixon Museum.
We get to party on your library. It's a part of the presidential legacy, isn't it?
It was. It was awesome.
Even today, I know Bush is building a library. Clinton built a library. A part of the deal.
Yes.
Think Obama will build one in Chicago?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think everyone's going to have their libraries. And the libraries will get more interesting. They'll become more interesting social spaces, too.
Now, Dr. Future, we only have a couple more minutes here left of our show for today, February 8th, 2011. What do we want to talk about?
Well, I'm going to give you some more personal experiences you can have. There's also the Julia map that just was released to the general public, and that is a way to explore fractals, particularly the Julia set and the Mandelbrot set. Fantastic visuals of what Julia mathematics are all about. Incredibly beautiful, and it's available as a Julia map generator in your browser. So anybody can experience this. Just search for Julia map Google Labs. And you'll find that.
And you're saying that your browser can generate a fractal. What's a fractal?
Well, you have to see it to believe it.
You have to see it to believe it.
It really is one of the basic mathematics found in nature. And to see it in its pure form is nothing short of beautiful and amazing.
So it's like a cross-section of maybe a seashell?
A fractal is a geometry, a very, very complex geometry that as you zoom in, you still see it, the form. You can zoom in infinitely, and it's an infinite zoom in or out. It's hard to explain, but it's a microcosm, macrocosm, all rolled into one.
And this is found at your favorite place, the Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Accelerating intelligence.
You'll find that on the DrFutureShow.com page. That's a personal experience that you can check out. A couple other news items. Well, I guess we'll save it for next week. But space habitats are now being leased. We'll save that for next week.
All right. Let's talk about it next week.
All right. Sounds like the time is now for us to leave you.
And be sure and get to your city council meeting tonight and speak up for your local libraries. 6 o'clock.
You've been listening to KSEO, Dr. Future Show.
Thanks for checking in, folks. Hope you enjoyed the show.
Charlie's up next. Bye.